And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Hi, I'm Uncle Dennis, and it is Thursday, July 23rd, and we're recording this Earth First Update from a secret Northwest recording location. I'd suggest you have a pencil and paper handy because you never know when there might be something you want to write down, email address, web page, telephone number, even an address. Something you might want to recall later and take action on. Let's start with news from Sea Shepherd. The United States and German nationals face up to 2 years imprisonment in the Faroe Islands if found guilty of defending whales. Susan Larson of San Francisco and Tom Sterath of Bremen, Germany, could face up to 2 years imprisonment if they are found guilty of breaching the Faroese Pilot Whaling Act. The Sea Shepherd volunteers were arrested on Monday morning following an attempted Grindr drop, the infamous drive hunt of cetaceans in the Faroe Islands just north of Kalvsvik in the northeast of the island archipelago. Faroese authorities have so far indicated that Sea Shepherd volunteers will be charged under Section 9 of the Act. However, despite requests by their legal representative for more information, police have provided no further details as to the exact nature of the charges against the pair. A court date has been set for today. Larson, who was the driver of the Sea Shepherd's small boat Farley at the time she was arrested, and Sterath, who was the boat's navigator, are in the Faroese Islands as part of Sea Shepherd's 2015 Pilot Whale Defense Campaign, Operation Sleped Grindini. Operation Sleped Grindini land team leader Rosie Kinnick believes that the police's inability to confirm details of the charges against Larson and Sterath indicates that there is a lack of evidence of any wrongdoing by the pair. Faroese authorities are obviously keen to flex the muscle of their ramped-up laws, but as yet have provided nothing in the way of evidence to support any claims against Susan and Tom, said Kinnick. The arrest occurred at approximately 9 o'clock local time Monday morning. The Sea Shepherd, Sam Simon, and the Farley have been investigating a flotilla of approximately 15 local boats that was on the move heading north past the killing beach of Klaksvik. The Danish Navy vessel HDMS Triton was also in the region. Although the Sea Shepherd vessels could not see pilot whales in the area, the heightened activity is generally indicative of a pilot whale drive hunt. Shortly after, a flotilla of boats stopped moving north, at which time the San Simon and the Farley also stopped moving. The Farley was approximately 1 nautical mile on the port side of the San Simon. Faroese police then boarded the small boat and arrested the two volunteers. At the time the arrests were made, the Triton moved into position between the Sam Simon and the Farley so that the small boat was not visible to the crew of the conservation ship. The Danish naval vessel then confiscated the Farley, handing it over to the custody of Faroese police, where it is still being held. Speaking about the incident, Larson stated, "While I am frustrated by our arrests and the seizure of the Farley, I hope that this incident will bring attention to what is happening to pilot whales and other cetaceans in the Faroe Islands. I was dismayed at our arrests that were made with the assistance of the Danish Navy. This is a clear indication that Denmark, an anti-whaling nation, is not only complicit in the slaughter of whales, but is deeply invested in seeing that grinds are successfully carried out. For hundreds of years, the people of the Danish Faroe Islands have been herding migratory pilot whales and other small cetaceans into shallow water and slaughtering them. The Grindadrop is the largest slaughter of marine mammals in Europe and is widely criticized as being both cruel and unnecessary. Strath stated, "While the rest of Europe protects pilot whales, in the Faroe Islands they continue to be slaughtered with the help of Denmark. I'm glad that our arrests have brought attention to the Grindadrop, and I hope that my experience helps other EU nationals to take a stand against this barbaric tradition which is taking place in our backyard." Captain Adam Meyerson of the San Simon has congratulated Larson and Sterath on their handling of the ordeal. "Susan and Tom remain composed and focused during their arrest. I am proud of them for standing strong in the face of harassment by the Faroese police, while being accused of a ridiculous crime of protecting marine mammals, he said. Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has been a leading opposition to the Grindadrop since the early 1980s. Operation Leopard Grindini is Sea Shepherd's sixth pilot whale defense campaign in the region. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife partner agencies conclude Operation Yurok in Humboldt County. Marijuana eradication effort focused on the misuse of water and habitat. Officers from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife recently participated in a large-scale multi-agency operation to address the devastating effects of illegal marijuana cultivation on fish, wildlife, and the environment in Northern California's watersheds. The four-day mission concluded on Thursday, July 16th. Allied law enforcement agencies include the State Water Resources Control Board, Yurok Tribal Police, Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, and federal law enforcement teamed with CDFW officers to serve dozens of search warrants, investigate pollution and water diversion crimes, and eradicate numerous marijuana plants as part of a joint effort dubbed Operation Yurok. More than 100 environmental violations of the Fish and Game Code were discovered, and 8 suspects were arrested. Charges are pending for additional suspects. This operation was about more than just the criminality of marijuana cultivation, said Lieutenant Dwayne Little of CDFW's Watershed Enforcement Team. At its roots, it was about protection of the environment. Created by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife in the last year, the Watershed Enforcement Team is comprised of both law enforcement officers and biologists, whose primary mission is to take an all-encompassing approach to investigating and protecting waterways from diversion, obstructions, alteration, pollution, and litter. During this period of unprecedented drought, water conservation is gravely important. An average mature marijuana plant consumes an estimated 6 to 12 gallons of water per day. Operation Yurok teams eradicated more than 29,000 thirsty marijuana plants from the area, which equates to hundreds of thousands of gallons of water per day that will no longer be diverted and prevented from feeding the nearby Klamath River. The Klamath River is considered by the locals to be a lifeline for many people. Water flows from the river must be great enough to sustain local drinking water needs and support successful salmon runs, which equate to a food source for the local Yurok tribe. Yurok tribal members and other locals have expressed great concern about illegal marijuana grows in the area due to the Klamath River's historic low levels. And moving to news from England on the Earth First Newswire, former girlfriend of corporate spy who posed as an Earth First activist is suing a security firm. Environmental activist who had a relationship with spy Mark Kennedy is now taking legal action against Global Open, thought to be the first lawsuit of its kind. This story written by Rob Evans, found in The Guardian and listed on the Earth First Newswire. An environmental campaigner who had an intimate relationship with an undercover spy is suing a corporate security firm in what is believed to be the first legal action of its kind. The woman is taking legal action against Global Open, a commercial firm hired by companies to monitor protesters. She alleges in the high court case that Mark Kennedy pursued her to start the relationship while, she says, he worked undercover for Global Open. Kennedy had previously worked for the police as an undercover officer and used a false identity to infiltrate environmental groups for 7 years. He maintained his fake persona after he left the police. She alleges that he used this fake identity to continue spying on protesters under the direction and control of Global Open while they were having a sexual relationship. Global Open, which is contesting the lawsuit and has filed a defense, is understood to argue that Kennedy did not work undercover for it. Disclosure of the lawsuit comes as the Home Secretary, Theresa May, prepares to announce this month the remit of a judge-held public inquiry into the undercover infiltration of hundreds of political groups in England since 1968. More than 10 women had long-term relationships with undercover police officers have been taking legal action against the police. In the first settlement, the Metropolitan Police last year paid more than £400,000 to a woman who discovered by chance that the father of her son was an undercover police officer. However, the lawsuit against Global Open is believed to be the first one of its nature launched against a corporate security firm. Global Open, established by a former security branch officer, Rod Leeming, is one of a number of private security firms that operate in a largely secretive world. Big companies such as energy producers and arms dealers hire firms to monitor protesters who are organizing campaigns against them. Like the women suing the police, this woman, who has been granted anonymity during the legal case against Global Open, says she suffered psychiatric damage after discovering the true identity of her one-time boyfriend. The woman, who has been active in environmental groups for many years, knew Kennedy only casually while he worked for the police. His covert mission for the police started in 2003 when he appeared in radical groups in Nottingham with the elaborate fictional persona of Mark Stone, a professional climber with an apparently disreputable criminal past. He gathered information about campaigners until he resigned from the police in early 2010. However, he had reappeared in Nottingham, still pretending to be Stone. The woman says that from February 2010, he began to positively seek out a relationship with her. She says she fell in love with him after he invited her to stay on his canal boat in Nottingham the following month. She adds that Kennedy had to go deliberately out of his way to make and sustain his relationship with her, as she lives some distance from Nottingham. She says Kennedy gathered inside information about government environmental campaigners and planned protests while working for Global Open. He also became involved in campaigning on animal rights issues, something he had previously shown no interest in, according to several campaigners. The woman says that monitoring animal rights protests was a core focus of Global Open's work. Kennedy was exposed as a police spy by the activists he had been spying on in October of 2010. Within hours, she says, he traveled to her house and confessed his real identity and covert police role, leaving her devastated. The relationship ended at that time. Asking for a comment about the legal action, Leeming, a director of Global Open, told The Guardian, "We are not allowed to talk about it anyway, and I wouldn't want to talk to you." 2 years ago, Kennedy told a parliamentary select committee, "When I first left the police, I was employed by Global Open and I assisted them in investigating a serious offense." Kennedy, who is not the subject of the lawsuit, has said that he did not work undercover for Global Open. He said he returned to Nottingham after he left the police in order to spend more time withdrawing from his fake identity in a credible way. The woman's lawyer, Beth Handley of Hickman & Rose Law Firm, said the lawsuit, which started in 2013, has reached an advanced stage. She has described the lawsuit in a submission to the Public Inquirer into the undercover policing of political groups, which is being led by Lord Justice Pitchford and has yet to open. Handley and the woman are pressing the Public Inquiry to examine the work of private security firms. Handley said the lawsuit raised important issues about the crossover between state and corporate monitoring of political movements and the unregulated nature of the private sector. Three women who had intimate relationships with Kennedy are part of the legal action against police chiefs. And there is no solace for food-deprived polar bears as sea ice wanes in this story, written by Will Dunham, with editing by Mohammed Zargam for World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Polar bears are the kings of the ice surface covering the top of the globe, but the ongoing loss of Arctic sea ice on which they hunt seals is causing summer food deprivation that threatens these imposing white-furred predators. Some experts had thought the bears might be able to mitigate the effects of reduced food intake by entering a walking hibernation during summers, an energy-conserving state of reduced activity and metabolic rate akin to the winter hibernation other bear species undertake. A study released on Thursday showed this is not happening. Researchers who monitored the body temperature, activity levels, and movements of 30 bears found they limited their summer energy expenditure a bit, but not enough to compensate for the food deprivation they face. The findings indicate that polar bears cannot use reduced metabolic rates to extend their reliance on stored body fat when food becomes scarce. They are unable to reduce their metabolism levels to levels similar to those in hibernation, University of Wyoming Zoology and Physiology Professor Marav Ben-David said. University of Wyoming biologist John Whiteman added, "We found that bears exhibited a typical mammalian response to food limitation in the summer, including slow, moderate declines in body temperature and activity. The loss of sea ice in the Arctic, attributed to rising temperatures amid global climate change, has prompted worry about the future of polar bears. They are specialized ice predators, hunting ringed and bearded seals from the surface of sea ice, mostly from April to June. During that time, they accumulate fat reserves that help them survive the summer when the sea ice melts. With rising temperatures, sea ice is melting earlier in the spring. In some areas, this has reduced bears' hunting opportunities and left them with diminished fat stores. Such a compromised body condition before winter could threaten their survival." Researchers collected data on bears on shore and on the ice of the Arctic Ocean's Beaufort Sea, north of Alaska and Canada. They surgically implanted tiny devices to record body temperature hourly and placed collars on the bears with satellite tracking technology to monitor activity levels. To this day, polar bears are tied to the ice. All bears spend the majority of their lives on the ice, and in some regions, bears are born and die on the ice, perhaps never setting foot on land, Whiteman said. The research appeared in the journal Science. And a new U.S. stream protection rule infuriates big coal in this story from Environment News Service. New national regulations to prevent or minimize the impacts of coal mining on surface water, groundwater, fish, and wildlife were proposed by the Obama administration. The stream protection rule would safeguard about 6,500 miles of streams nationwide over a 20-year period. The proposed stream protection rule would affect the ability of mountaintop removal coal mining companies to destroy or bury waterways near surface mining operations. Mountaintop removal mining has already buried more than 2,000 miles of streams in Appalachia, while 1,000 more miles have been poisoned by toxic mine waste. The National Mining Association and Industry Group was scathing in its criticism of the proposal, calling it the latest in a series of costly and unnecessary regulations from an administration that appears determined to destroy coal mining communities. But environmental groups warn the proposed rule is too weak and demand that the existing highly protective buffer zone requirement, which clearly prohibits harmful activities within 100 feet of streams, be fully implemented. Introducing the proposed rule, which could replace 1983 regulations, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell said the federal government will work with coal field communities to support their jobs while at the same time protecting the waterways near coal mines. "We are committed to working with coal field communities as we support economic activity while minimizing the impact coal production has on the environment that our children and grandchildren will inherit," she said. "This proposed rule would accomplish what Americans expect from their government," said Jewell, "a modern and balanced approach to energy development that safeguards our environment, protects water quality, supports the energy needs of the nation, and makes coal field communities more resilient for a diversified economic future." The proposed rule is meant to keep pace with current science, technology, and modern mining practices, she said. "It would require companies to avoid mining practices that permanently pollute streams, destroy drinking water sources, increase flood risk, and threaten forests." The rule would require coal companies to test and monitor the condition of streams that their mining might impact before, during, and after their operations. It would also require companies to restore streams and return mined over areas to the uses that they were capable of supporting prior to mining activities, replanting them with native trees and vegetation, unless a conflicting land use is implemented. The proposed rule is projected to have a minimal impact on the coal industry overall, said Interior Department officials in a statement. In developing the proposed rule, we conducted extensive public outreach and were informed by the interests of coal company residents and others, including those directly and indirectly employed by the industry and those living with the impacts of mining on a daily basis, said Joseph Pizarczyk, Director of Interior's Office of Surface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. That is why we are having a robust public comment process, Pizarczyk said, to provide all the stakeholders the opportunity to provide input on the proposed changes. The mining group is urging Congress to block the rule. This is a rule in search of a problem, said National Mining Association President and CEO Hal Quinn. The agency's own reports on existing state regulatory programs show the vast majority of mine sites are free of any off-site impacts, and the agency has produced no evidence to justify more regulations, let alone redundant ones that interfere with state agencies' mining and water quality laws. Quinn objects that the proposed rule was developed without the input of state agency experts. By ignoring state officials, OSM has made a mockery of the administration's pledge towards greater transparency. What OSM has made transparent is the need for Congress to bridle an agency and a rule that is more about extending its bureaucratic reach than improving environmental performance. For their part, the environmental groups complain that the rule doesn't go far enough. They warn the proposal weakens the stream buffer zone rule, which prohibits harmful mining activities within 100 feet of Appalachian streams. Appalachian communities rely on the rivers and streams covered by these protections, and today's proposal doesn't adequately safeguard those communities, said Sierra Club Beyond Coal Senior Director Bruce Miles. Tom Kay, legislative associate with the nonprofit group Appalachian Voices, said, "The people of Central Appalachia have waited a long time for robust federal action to protect their streams and communities from the damages of surface coal mining." Kay says the proposal still allows toxic mining waste to enter streams. At first glance, the draft appears to improve some drastically outdated provisions of an ineffective rule, but it's not worth cheering for the rule as long as it allows companies to continue dumping their mining waste in our streams, he said. Attorney Jane Davenport at Defenders of Wildlife said it is the responsibility of the Office of Surface Mining and state authorities to protect drinking water and wildlife habitat from the catastrophic effects of mountaintop removal mining. This proposal, though, it does encourage increased safety monitoring and stream restoration, just doesn't do the job. And Australia scrambles to rescue vanishing animals and birds in this story from Environment News Service. The Australian government has set new targets to protect and recover threatened animals, birds, and plants, and improve recovery practices under the nation's first threatened species strategy. At the Threatened Species Summit in Melbourne on Thursday, Environment Minister Greg Hunt set out the new strategy. The Threatened Species Strategy sets out the government's action plan to win the battle against extinction, commit $6.6 million Australian to threatened species projects to kickstart that plan, and invites others with a shared passion for the bush and its wildlife to contribute as well, said Hunt. Over time, plants and animals that once thrived on our continent have been pushed to the brink. We need to step in for their sake and for ours. There is a lot that can be done, from limiting the impacts of feral cats and creating safe havens to improve habitat and intervening in emergencies, but no one can do it alone, so today's summit brings together the people, organizations, and know-how to drive change. By 2020, I am setting hard targets for real improvements to 20 mammals and 20 birds on our national threatened species list, as well as for 30 priority plant species. That means humane culling of one of our wildlife's worst enemies, feral cats, said Hunt. The first 10 mammals identified for priority action are the numbat, mala, mountain pygmy possum, greater bilby, golden bandicoot, bush-tailed rabbit rat, eastern bittong, western quoll, Kangaroo Island dunart, and the eastern barred bandicoot. Two more, the Leadbeater's possum and central rock rat, will benefit from emergency intervention. The first 10 birds identified for priority action are the helmeted honeyeater, hooded plover, eastern bristlebird, regent honeyeater, Malay emu wren, plains wanderer, night parrot, alligator river's yellow chat, and Norfolk Island's green parrot and boobook owl. Two more, the orange-bellied parrot and western ground parrot, will benefit from emergency intervention. The remaining 8 species of mammals and 8 species of birds will be identified over the next 12 months in consultation with the community, said Hunt. Part of the strategy is to cull domestic cats gone wild because they attack native birds and mammals. Since their arrival in Australia, feral cats have contributed to the extinction of at least 27 mammal species. By 2020, I want to see 2 million feral cats culled, 5 new islands and 10 new mainland safe havens free of feral cats, and control measures applied across 10 million hectares, said Hunt. That's about 25 million acres. Hunt released the threat abatement plan to limit the damage done by feral cats 3 months of public consultation on the draft document. The feral cat culling projects are expected to benefit species as varied as the bilbies in Queensland, central rock rats in the Northern Territory, eastern barred bandicoots in Victoria, and orange-bellied parrots in Tasmania. But environmental groups say the government needs to do more to protect the habitats that endangered species need to survive. If Environment Minister Hunt is serious about saving forest-dependent threatened species found nowhere else on Earth, at risk of extinction because of ongoing logging, said Amelia Young, the Wilderness Society's Victoria's campaign manager. While Victoria's Leadbetter's possum is at today's summit to be listed for emergency interventions, state government logging continues in its forest habitat in the Central Islands, just an hour's drive east of Melbourne. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening, normally in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, but this week is being produced at a secret location in the Pacific Northwest. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of today's broadcast, tune in Friday at 3 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you are living in Moscow, Idaho, tune in to KRFP Radio Free Moscow at 90.3 FM, their new high-power frequency, at 9:30 p.m. on Monday nights. Or you could go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download any or all of the Earth First news updates. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio, and this week is being produced in a secret studio in the Pacific Northwest. I want to thank you for listening, and tune in next week for another Earth First Update.